This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Murder House, written by James Patterson and David Ellis, read by Therese Plummer and Jay Snyder. To Matt, Libby, and Zach Stennis. Prologue, Bridgehampton, 1995. When his eyes pop open, it is still dark outside. The air cool and crisp through his window. Normally, he wouldn't be up for another hour yet, but he could hardly sleep last night waiting for today. He's not sure, in fact, that he slept at all. He sees the long, narrow trombone case in the corner of his bedroom, and his heartbeat ratchets up. All those rehearsals, all those hours of practice until his hands and shoulders ached, until his head throbbed, all of that preparation comes down to today. It's finally here. He quickly brushes his teeth and puts on his Halloween costume. He picks up the trombone case and his school backpack and heads downstairs quietly, not wanting to wake his mother. He rips open the cellophane and drops two Pop-Tarts into the toaster and pours himself a glass of milk. He drinks the milk but doesn't touch the pastries. His stomach is churning too wildly. He will eat later, after his performance. It is still dark, a nip in the fresh air, as he leaves his house, backpack over his shoulder, trombone case in his left hand. At the end of his street, he looks to his right, where a half mile away he can see the fog of the Atlantic, dark and endless. His eyes invariably move to the house by the ocean, perched up on the hill, the haunted mansion that, even from a distance, scowls at him. No one ever leaves alive the house at 7 Ocean Drive. A shiver runs through him. He shakes it off and turns left, moving north on Ocean Drive. He alternates the trombone case between his left hand and his right because it's heavy, and he doesn't want it to affect his performance today. He perks up as he approaches the school from the south end. The morning air begins to warm, a refreshing break in the chill. The sun peeks through the treetops. Leaves of assorted colors dance in the wind. He stifles the instinct to skip along like an eager little boy. But he's no little boy. It's not like he's 8 or 10 anymore. He's the first one here, just as he planned, alone with an acre of grass, nothing but an expanse of open field leading up to the baseball diamond and playground to the south of the brick building. No trees, no shrubbery, no brick walls, nothing for the length of half a football field at least. He turns toward the woods on the east side and finds his perch. He opens the trombone case and removes the rifle, already fully loaded. He holds the rifle in his hands and takes a deep breath to calm his nerves. His heartbeat is at full throttle, catching in his throat, bringing a tremble to his limbs. He looks at his Star Wars watch, which he is wearing over his Halloween costume. The first bell, the warning bell, will come soon. Some of the students will arrive early, congregating near the back door, dispersing into their little cliques or tossing a football or frisbee around. The playground equipment for the younger kids. But it's not the younger kids he wants. He looks back at his watch, where Darth Vader tells him the time is drawing near. He wanted to dress up today as Darth, fitting for the occasion, but too clunky with the oversized helmet. Visibility through the rifle scope was nearly impossible when he tried it out. He loses himself in his thoughts, in his fantasies, in the dancing leaves, and suddenly time has crept up on him. They are arriving. Small kids holding their parents' hands, bouncing with animation. Older ones walking together. Superman and Batman and Aquaman, vampires and clowns, kittens and bunnies. Cinderella and Snow White and Tinkerbell, Pocahontas and Woody from Toy Story, Ronald Reagan and Simba from The Lion King, and Mr. Spock. And the oldest ones at the school, the juniors and seniors, a few of them with some obligatory face paint or semblance of costume, but generally too cool to dress up like their younger classmates. Showtime, he says. He heard that word in a cable movie he wasn't supposed to watch and thought it sounded cool. His body temperature jacks up beneath his costume. Showtime, he says again as he raises his rifle, but this time he finds his voice, strong and confident, and then everything changes, like the flip of a switch inside him. A sense of calm sweeps through him, itself exhilarating. Look at him. Look at him patiently walking out from the tree cover, rifle raised, aiming and firing and clicking in the next round, aiming and firing and clicking, aim, fire, click, while he walks toward the unsuspecting masses. The pop of the rifle, with each pull of the trigger, is the most invigorating sensation he's ever felt. Jimmy Traeger howls in a combination of pain and surprise as his back arches and he staggers to the ground. Roger Ackerman, that asshole, clutches his arm and tries to run but stumbles into the leaves. Visible in the clearing now, he drops to one knee to steady himself as screams and cries fill the air, as 50, 60 kids scatter in all directions like cockroaches, bumping into one another, tripping over one another, dropping their school bags and covering their heads, unsure initially which way to run, heads whipping in all directions, only knowing they should run, run, run. By the trees, one parent yells. The parking lot, cries another. He fires and clicks in the next round. Aim, fire, click, while panic propels the population of students like a strong gust of wind. Their squeals are like music. Their terror is his oxygen. He wishes this moment would never end. 6 hit, 7, 8 in the clearing near him, another half dozen farther away. And then he raises his rifle with a dramatic flare and takes a moment, just a moment, to savor the delicious scene, the power he holds, the havoc he has created. It's like nothing he's ever felt. It's beyond words, this rush, this thrill coursing through him. And then his vision blurs, and it's a moment before he realizes it's not the wind causing it, but his own tears. There are probably a dozen pellets left in his BB rifle, but he's out of time. Faculty will pour out of the building any second. The STPD will be called. And he accomplished what he wanted anyway. Just some superficial pellet wounds. But wow, was that fun. And I'm only 12 years old, he thinks. You ain't seen nothing yet. Book 1. Bridgehampton, 2011. Chapter 1. Noah Walker stands carefully on the roof of his house, takes a moment to ensure his balance, and removes the Yankees cap from his head to wipe the sweat off his brow under the scorching early June sun. He never minded roofing work, but it's different when it's your own roof, the place you're renting. And the only reason you're doing it is the landlord will take 6 months to get to it, and you're sick of water spots on the ceiling. He runs his hands through his thick, wavy hair. The Matthew McConaughey look, Paige calls it, noting that he has the physique to match. He's heard that comparison for years and never thought much of it. He never thought much of what anyone thought or said about him. If he did, he sure as hell wouldn't still be living in the Hamptons. He hears the crunch of car tires down the road, the hum of a powerful, well-maintained engine. The unpaved roads just off Sag Harbor Turnpike are uneven at best, sometimes bumpy and other times outright treacherous. Not like the roads by the ocean, by the 40,000-square-foot mansions where the elite like to summer. Not that he should bitch too much about the Blue Bloods. He makes twice as much from May to August doing their bidding as he does the rest of the year combined. He fixes what they need fixed. He digs what they need dug. He stomachs their condescension. Paige, he says to himself, even before her black-on-black Aston Martin convertible pulls into his driveway and parks next to his 19-year-old reconstructed Harley. She's not being discreet. She should probably be more careful. But back here in the woods where he lives, people don't mingle with the wealth, so there's no real danger of this getting back to Paige's husband, John Saltzman. It's not like his neighbors are going to run into Paige's husband at some high society event. The closest people like him have ever come to a tuxedo is watching penguins on the Discovery Channel. Same zip code, different world. Paige floats out of her convertible with the same grace with which she always carries herself. Noah feels the primal yearning that always accompanies the first sight of her. Paige Saltzman is one of those people for whom beauty is effortless. A privilege, not a chore. in her white hat and polka dot dress, one hand holding the hat in place in the wind. She looks every bit the Manhattan socialite she is, but she hails from upstate originally and has maintained a sense of proportion and humility. Paige. There's something refreshing about her. She is a natural beauty with her shiny blonde hair and killer figure, her softly upturned nose and stunning hazel eyes. But it's not just her looks. She has a sharp wit, the ability to laugh at herself, the manners of a well-raised girl. She's one of the most sincere and decent people he's ever known. She's pretty good in bed, too. Noah climbs down the back and meets her inside the house. She rushes to him and plants her lips against his, her hands on his bare chest. "I thought you were in Manhattan," he says. She gives him a mock pout with those juicy lips.
"That's not much of a greeting, mister. How about, Paige, I'm so very thrilled to see you."
"I am thrilled." And he is. He first saw Paige 3 years ago when he was cleaning the gutters on the Sulzman estate. Her image lingered with him long after. It was only 6 weeks ago that the stars aligned. The prospect of Paige has always been both exhilarating and terrifying. Exhilarating because he's never met someone who could light that flame inside him quite like she can. And terrifying because she's married to John Sulzman. But all of that can wait. The electricity between them is palpable. His big, rough hands trace the outline of her dress, cup her impressive breasts, run through her silky hair as she lets out gentle moans and works the zipper on his blue jeans.
"I'm going to leave him," she says to him between halting breaths. "I'm going to do it."
"You can't," says Noah. "He'll kill you." She lets out a small gasp as Noah's hand reaches inside her panties.
"I'm tired of being afraid of him. I don't care what he, Noah.
He lifts her off her feet and they bump against the front door, pushing it closed with a thud, a sound that seems to coincide with a similar sound, another door closing outside. Noah carries Paige into the family room. He lays her down on the rug and rips her dress open, buttons flying, and brings his mouth to her breasts, then slides down to her panties. A moment later, her underwear has been removed and her legs are wrapped around his neck, her moans growing more urgent until she is calling out his name. He moves upward and works his jeans down, freeing himself. He braces himself over Paige and gently slides inside her, her back arching in response. They find a rhythm, first slow and then urgent, and the sensation courses through Noah, the intensity building, the dam about to burst. Then he hears another door closing, then another. He stops suddenly and raises his head.
"Someone's here," he says.
Chapter 2. Noah pulls on his underwear and scrambles to his haunches, staying low.
"Are you sure your husband? I don't see how."
She doesn't see how? John Sulzman has endless resources, more money than some small countries. He easily could have tailed someone like Paige, who is far too innocent to notice something like that. Noah takes one deep breath, his heartbeat slows, and his veins turn icy. He finds his jeans on the floor and fishes the knife out of his back pocket.
"Go upstairs and hide," he tells Paige.
"I'm not going anywhere."
He doesn't bother to argue the point. Paige wouldn't listen anyway. And besides, they're not here for Paige. They're here for him. Noah hears movement outside, not voices and nothing deliberate, which makes it worse. They aren't announcing themselves. He stays low and slips out of the living room, but not before catching a glimpse through the window of bodies in motion, some rushing around the side of the house, others toward the front door. A small army is descending on his house, and he has nothing but a roofing knife. In the hallway now, he faces the front door. There is little point in hiding. If he hid, they'd find him, and they'd be braced for action when they did, their guns poised, fanned out in some defensive formation. No, his only option is to get them when they come in, when they think they're sneaking in on a lover's tryst, when they think Noah won't be ready for them, surprise them, hurt them, and escape. He hears the back door slam open at the same time that the front doorknob turns slowly.
They're coming from both directions at once. He has almost no chance. But he has nothing to lose, he figures, as he tightens his grip on the knife. He moves one leg back, like a sprinter locking into his blocks before a race, ready to spring toward the front door with his knife as the doorknob completes its rotation, as his pulse drums in his throat, as the front door pops open. He lunges forward, ready to sweep the knife upward. A woman, a redhead dressed in blue jeans and a flak jacket, a gun held at her side, a badge dangling from a lanyard around her neck. A badge. He tries to halt his momentum, falling to his knees, sliding forward. The woman spins and kicks up her leg, and Noah sees the treads of her shoe just before impact. His head snaps back from the kick. His body arches and his head smacks the floor, stars and jagged lines dancing on the ceiling.
Drop the knife or I drop you,
she said evenly.
STPD.
Noah blinks hard, his heartbeat still hammering. STPD. The police?
Toss the knife, Noah,
says the red-headed cop as several other officers flood in behind her. Jesus, okay. Noah drops the knife to the floor. Blood drips into the back of his mouth. A searing pain shoots through his nose and eyes. Don't move, the other officers yell at Paige. Hands in the air. Don't hurt her, Noah says. She didn't do any.
Noah, you resist me again and I'll put you in the hospital.
The redhead puts her foot on his chest. Despite his predicament and the pain drumming through his head and the fear gripping his heart, he registers this cop for the first time. Her striking ice blue eyes, her shiny red hair pulled back, her confidence. What? What is this? He manages. His initial reaction of relief, nobody's going to kill him, is short-lived, especially with the crew of cops flooding in from the back now. 10 officers, he guesses, all wearing bulletproof vests and heavily armed. Why?
You don't have the right to do this,
Paige shouts from the other room. It comes out as half protest, half lecture, the kind of thing a person with money would say, someone who doesn't shrink in the face of the cops like others might. About the only thing Noah can see, through his blurred vision, is the female cop staring down at him. He's in his underwear, flat on his back with her foot on his chest and a pretty good shiner developing from the kick to his face. But hearing Paige's cry sets off something within him.
This is my home,
he hisses, his hands forming into fists. You have a problem with me? Knock on my door and tell me.
We have a problem with you, Noah,
she says.
Feel better?
Noah's eyes catch Detective Isaac Marks, whom Noah has known for years, going back to school days. Marks doesn't give much of a reaction, save for a small shrug of one shoulder. The redhead orders Noah to roll over. She cuffs him and yanks him to his feet. The sudden movement, coupled with the concussive effects from the kick to his face, leaves Noah's legs unsteady.
This is ridiculous, he says. Does Dr. Redmond say I took his Rolex again? Tell him to look in the couch cushions.
It wouldn't be the first time one of the gazillionaires misplaced something and accused the help of pilfering it. A movie producer once had Noah arrested for stealing his golf clubs, only to realize later he'd left them in the trunk of his car.
And do you think you brought enough cops?
Is that why you rushed me with a knife?
Asks the redhead.
Because you thought I wanted to question you about a watch?
He knows this isn't about a Rolex.
Noah recognizes the voice before he sees Langdon James swagger into the house. He's been the chief of the Southampton Town Police Department for over 15 years. His jowls now hang over his collar, his belly over his belt, and his hair has gone completely gray, but he still has the baritone voice and thick sideburns. What the hell is the chief doing here?
Detective Murphy, the chief says to the redhead. Take him to the station. I'll handle the search of his house. Will someone tell me what's going on?
Noah demands, unable to conceal the fear choking his voice.
Be happy to, says the chief. Noah Walker, you're under arrest for the murders of Melanie Phillips and Zachary Stern.
Chapter 3. The funeral for Melanie Phillips is heavily attended, filling the pews of the Presbyterian Church and overflowing onto Main Street. She was all of 20 years old when she was murdered, every day of which she lived in Bridgehampton. Poor girl. Never got to see the world. Though for some people, the place you grew up is your world. Maybe that was Melanie. Maybe all she ever wanted was to be a waitress at Tasty's Diner, serving steamers and lobster to tourists and townies and the occasional rich couple looking to drink in the local environment. But with her looks, at least from what I've seen in photos, she probably had bigger plans. A young woman like that, with luminous brown hair and sculpted features, could have been in magazines. That, no doubt, is why she caught the attention of Zach Stern, the head of a talent agency that included A-list celebrities, a man who owned his own jet and who liked to hang out in the Hamptons now and then. And that, no doubt, is also why she caught the attention of Noah Walker, who apparently had quite an affinity for young Melanie himself and must not have taken too kindly to her affair with Zach. It was only 4 nights ago that Zachary Stern and Melanie Phillips were found dead, victims of a brutal murder in a rental house near the beach that Zach had leased for the week. The carnage was brutal enough that Melanie's service was closed casket. So the crowd is due in part to Melanie's local popularity and in part to the media interest, given Zach Stern's notoriety in Hollywood. It is also due, I am told, to the fact that the murders occurred at 7 Ocean Drive, which among the locals has become known as the Murder House. Now we've moved to the burial, which is just next door to the church. It allows the throng that couldn't get inside the church to mill around the south end of the cemetery, where Melanie Phillips will be laid to rest. There must be 300 people here, if you count the media, which for the most part are keeping a respectful distance, even while they snap their photographs. The overhead sun at midday is strong enough for squinting and sunglasses, both of which make it harder for me to do what I came here to do, which is to check out the people attending the funeral to see if anyone pings my radar. Some of these creeps like to come and watch the sorrow they caused, so it's standard operating procedure to scan the crowd at crime scenes and funerals. "Remind me why we're here, Detective Murphy," says my partner, Isaac Marks. "I'm paying my respects." "You didn't know Melanie," he says. "True enough. I don't know anyone around here. Once upon a time, my family came here every summer, a good 3-week stretch straddling June and July, to stay with Uncle Langdon and Aunt Chloe. My memories of those summers, beaches and boat rides and fishing off the docks, end at age 8. For some reason I never knew, my family stopped coming after that. Until 9 months ago when I joined the force, I hadn't set foot in the Hamptons for 18 years. "I'm working on my suntan," I say. "Not to mention," says Isaac, ignoring my remark, "that we already have our bad guy in custody." "Also true. We arrested Noah Walker yesterday. He'll get a bond hearing tomorrow, but there's no way the judge is going to bond him out on a double murder." "And might I further add," says Isaac, "that this isn't even your case." "Right again. I volunteered to lead the team arresting Noah, but I wasn't given the case. In fact, the chief, my aforementioned Uncle Langdon, is handling the matter personally. The town, especially the hoity-toity millionaires along the beach, just about busted a collective gut when the celebrity agent Zach Stern was brutally murdered in their scenic little hamlet. It's the kind of case that could cost the chief his job if he isn't careful. I'm told the town supervisor has been calling him on the hour for updates. So why am I here? At a funeral for someone I don't know, on a case that isn't mine? Because I'm bored. Because since I left the NYPD, I haven't seen any action. And because I've handled more homicides in 8 years on the force than all of these cops in Bridgehampton put together. Translation? I wanted the case, and I was a little displeased when I didn't get it. "Who's that?" I ask, gesturing across the way to an odd-looking man in a green cap, with long, stringy hair and ratty clothes. Deep-set, creepy eyes that seem to wander. He shifts his weight from foot to foot, unable to stay still. Isaac pushes down his sunglasses to get a better look. "Oh, that's Aiden Willis," he says. "He works for the church. Probably dug Melanie's grave. Looks like he slept in it first." Isaac likes that. "Seriously, Murphy, you're looking for suspects? With all you know about this case, which is diddly squat, you don't like Noah Walker for the murders?" "I'm not saying that," I answer.
"You're not denying it either."
I consider that. He's right, of course. What the hell do I know about Noah Walker or the evidence against him? He may not have jumped out at me as someone who'd just committed a brutal double murder, but when do public faces ever match private misdeeds? I once busted a second-grade school teacher who was selling heroin to the high school kids, and a teenage volunteer who was boning the corpses in the basement of the hospital. You never know people. And I'd known Noah Walker for all of 30 minutes. "Go home," says Isaac. "Go work out." "Already did this morning." "Or see the ocean." "I've seen it already. It's a really big body of water." "Or have a drink." "Yeah, a glass of wine might be in my future. But first, I'm going to take a quick detour. A detour that could probably get me in a lot of trouble."
Chapter 4. Langdon James closes his eyes for just a moment and raises his face to the sun shining down on the backyard cocktail party. In these moments, with a slight buzz from the gin and the elite of Southampton surrounding him, he likes to pretend he is one of them, one of the socialites, the mega wealthy, the trust fund babies and personal injury lawyers, the songwriters and tennis pros, the TV producers and stock speculators. He is not, of course. He wasn't born with a silver spoon, and he was always more street savvy than book smart. But he has found another route to power, through a badge, and most of the time that is enough. There are at least 100 people in the sprawling backyard, most of them blue bloods, all of them here to support the re-election of town supervisor Dawn McKitteridge and her slate. But really here to be seen, to eat elaborate hors d'oeuvres served by waiters in white coats and talk about their latest acquisition or conquest. They don't live here year-round, and the only relevance the governing authorities of the town hold for them is the rare zoning issue that may arise, water rights, land use, and the like. Or, in Chief James's case, the occasional drug bust or DUI or dalliance with prostitutes from Sag Harbor.
"Nice day, Chief."
Langdon turns to see John Salzman. He's had a place on the ocean in Bridgehampton, a tiny hamlet incorporated within Southampton, for over a decade now. Salzman made his money in hedge funds and now spends half his time in D.C. and Albany, lobbying legislatures and cutting deals. His net worth, according to a New York Post article Langdon read last year, is upwards of $500 million. Salzman's on his third marriage to the lovely Paige, and what appears to be his third or fourth scotch, judging from the slurring of his words. He's wearing a button-down shirt with the collar open and white slacks. He is overweight, with a round, weathered face and a full head of hair if you count the toupee. One of the better ones Langdon has seen, but still. Don't these guys realize everybody knows?
"John," says the chief.
"I understand Noah Walker is in custody," says Salzman, as if he's commenting on the weather. "I understand you were there personally."
"I was." The chief takes a sip of his gin. No lime, no tonic, no stir. To all appearances, he could be drinking ice water, which is the point.
"I saw the police report," says Salzman. "What was in it and what was not?"
His wife, he means. The chief didn't mention Paige in the police report, thus concealing her presence from the media. John Salzman probably thinks he did it to curry favor, but he didn't. There was no need to include her. She had nothing to do with the arrest, other than being a bystander. But if Salzman sees it as a favor, well, there are worse things.
"It's not a well-kept secret that you have your eyes on the sheriff's job, chief."
Langdon doesn't answer, but Salzman is right. The Suffolk County Sheriff is retiring, and it would be a nice cap-off to Langdon's law enforcement career. Salzman raises his glass in acknowledgement.
"Ambition is what makes the world go round. It's what drives men to excel at their jobs."
"I always try to do my best," says the chief.
"And I try to reward those who do."
Salzman takes a long drink and breathes out with satisfaction.
"If Noah Walker is convicted, I'll consider you to have excelled at your job, and I'll be eager to support your next endeavor. Are you familiar with my fundraising efforts, Chief?"
It so happens that the chief is, but he doesn't acknowledge it.
"I can raise millions for you, or I could raise millions for your opponent.
And who would my opponent be? The chief looks at Salzman. Salzman shrugs and cocks his head.
Whoever I want it to be.
He taps the chief's arm.
And do you know who else is familiar with my fundraising efforts? Our town supervisor, your boss.
Chief James takes another sip of his gin.
Would that be a threat? A threat? No, chief. A promise. If Noah Walker goes free, there will be people in this community, maybe I'll be one of them, who will call for your head.
John Salzman is not known for his subtlety. When you're worth $500 million, you probably don't have to be. So if Noah is convicted, the chief is a lock to be the next sheriff. If Noah walks, the chief can kiss his current job and any future in law enforcement goodbye.
Noah Walker is going to be convicted, says the chief, because he's guilty.
Of course he is, Salzman nods. Of course.
This conversation should be over. It never should have started, but it should definitely end now. A guy like Salzman is smart enough to know that. And yet Salzman hasn't left. He has something else to say.
There's a new officer on the case? He asks. A woman?
The chief whips his head over to Salzman.
Your niece,
says Salzman, clearly pleased with himself for the knowledge he's obtained, and happy to throw it in the chief's face.
Jenna Murphy.
Jenna's not on the case, says the chief. She handled the arrest, that's all.
I only mention it because I understand she had some issues with the NYPD,
says Salzman. The only issue she had is she's an honest cop, Langdon snaps. Truth is, the day she arrived, she was the best cop on our force. She's as smart as they come, and she's tough and honest, and she wouldn't put up with corruption found in Manhattan. She wouldn't go along with dirty cops, and she wouldn't look the other way.
Salzman nods and purses his lips. It's not her case, John, says the chief.
Salzman appraises the chief, looking him up and down, then square in the eye.
I just care about the result, he says. Make it happen. Make sure Noah Walker goes into a very deep hole, or there will be consequences.
Noah Walker is going into a hole because
he's guilty, says Salzman. Yes, I know, Lang. Just don't forget this conversation. You want me as a friend, not an enemy.
With that, John Salzman makes his exit, joining some acquaintances under the shade of the tent. Chief Langdon James watches him leave, then decides he's had enough of this party.
Chapter 5. As the funeral for Melanie Phillips ends, I say goodbye to my partner, Detective Isaac Marks, without telling him where I'm going. He doesn't need to know, and I don't know if he'd keep the information to himself. I'm not yet sure where his loyalties lie, and I'm not going to make the same mistake I made with the NYPD. I decide to walk, heading south from the cemetery toward the Atlantic. I always underestimate the distance to the ocean, but it's a nice day for a walk, even if a little steamy. And I enjoy the houses just south of Main Street along this road, the white-trim Cape Cods with cedar shingles whose colors have grown richer with age from all the precipitation that comes with proximity to the ocean. Some are bigger, some are newer, but these houses generally look the same, which I find comforting and a little creepy at the same time. As I get closer to the ocean, the plots of land get wider, the houses get bigger, and the privacy shrubs flanking them get taller. I stop when I reach shrubbery that's a good 10 feet high. I know I found the place because the majestic wrought iron gates at the end of the driveway, which are slightly parted, are adorned with black and yellow tape that says, Crime Scene, Do Not Cross. I slide between the gates without breaking the seal. I start up the driveway, but it curves off to some kind of carriage house up a hill. So I take the stone path that will eventually lead me to the front door. In the center of the wide expanse of grass, just before it slopes dramatically upward, there is a small stone fountain with a monument jutting up that bears a crest and an inscription. I lean over the fountain to take a closer look. The small tablet of stone features a bird in the center, with a hooked beak and a long tail feather. encircled by little symbols, each of which appears to be the letter X, but which upon closer inspection is a series of crisscrossing daggers. And then, kaboom. It hits me. The rush, the pressure in my chest, the stranglehold to my throat. I can't breathe. I can't see. I'm weightless. Help me. Somebody please help me. I stagger backward, almost losing my balance, and suck in a deep, delicious breath of air. Wow, I say into the warm breeze. Easy, girl. Take it easy. I wipe greasy sweat from my forehead and inhale and exhale a few more times to slow my pulse. Beneath the monument's crest, carved into the stone in a thick Gothic font, are these words. Cecilia, oh Cecilia, life was death disguised. Okay, that's pretty creepy. I take a photo of the monument with my smartphone. Now, front and center before the house, I take my first good look. The mansion peering down at me from atop the hill is a Gothic structure of faded, multicolored limestone. It has a Victorian look to it, with multiple roof lines, all of them steeply pitched. Fancy turrets, chimneys grouped at each end. There are elaborate medieval-style accents on the facade. Every peak is topped with an ornament that ends in a sharp point, like spears aimed at the gods. The windows are long and narrow, clover-shaped with stained glass. The house is like one gigantic, imperious frown. I've heard some things about this house, read some things, even passed by it many times, but seeing it up close like this sends a chill through me. It is part cathedral and part castle. It is a scowling, menacing, imposing structure, both regal and haunting, almost romantic in its gloom. All it's missing is a drawbridge and a moat filled with crocodiles. This is 7 Ocean Drive. This is what they call the murder house. This isn't your case, I remind myself. This isn't your problem. This could cost you your badge, girl. I start up the hill toward the front door. Chapter 6. I'm transported back hundreds of years to a time when you rode by horseback or carriage, when you lived by candlelight and torches, when you treated infections with leeches. When I close the front door of the house at 7 Ocean Drive, the sound echoes up to the impossibly high rounded ceiling, decorated with an ornate fresco of winged angels and naked women and bearded men in flowing robes, all of them appearing to reach toward something, or maybe toward one another. The second anteroom is as chilling and dated as the first, with patterned tile floors and more of the arched Old Testament ceilings, antique furniture, gold-framed portraits on the walls of men dressed in ruffled shirts and long coats, wigs of wavy white hair and sharply angled hats. Formal wear circa 1700. The guy who built this place, the patriarch of the family, a guy named Winston Dahlquist, apparently didn't have a sense of humor. My heels echo on the hardwood floor as I enter the airy foyer rising up 3 stories to the roof. Every step I take elicits a reaction from this house, fleeting coughs and groans. Hello? I say, like a child might, the sound returning to me faintly. The stairs up to the second floor are winding and predictably creaky. The house continues to call out from parts unseen. Aches and hiccups and wheezes. A centuries-old creature drawing long, labored breaths. When I reach the landing, it seizes me again, stealing the air from my lungs, pressing against my chest, blinding me. No, please, please, please stop! High-pitched, childlike squeals, uncontrollable laughter. Please don't do this to me! I grasp the banister so I don't fall back down the stairs. I open my eyes and raise my face, panting for air, until my heartbeat finally decelerates. Get a grip, Murphy. I pass through ornate double doors to the second floor hallway where the smell greets me immediately. The coppery odor of spilled blood. The overpowering putrid scent of decay. I walk along a thick red carpet, the walls papered with red and gold as I approached the bedroom where Zack Stern and Melanie Phillips took their last breaths. I step onto the dark hardwood floor and look around the room. Gold wallpaper is everywhere. Against one wall is a king-sized canopy bed with thick purple curtains and sturdy bedposts. The bed is dressed in a purple comforter and ruffle with velvet pillows, some of which are still on the bed, some of which lie on the floor. The dark wood dresser holds two pewter statuettes that were probably bookends for the thick volumes of short stories that also now lie on the floor. The statuettes, as well as an antique brass alarm clock, are knocked to the side on the dresser. Opposite the bed, made of wood that matches the dresser, is a giant armoire. And in the far corner of the room, south of the armoire and west of the dresser, is the bathroom. I remove copies of the crime scene photos I Xeroxed from the file. Zachary Stern was found lying face down on the floor, his head turned to the right toward the door, his feet pointed toward the bed. Beneath him was a pool of blood and other bodily excrement from the horrific stab wound to his midsection. Several of his fingers were crushed as well. Melanie Phillips was found by the armoire opposite the bed, the back of her right hand touching the armoire's leg. She was lying on her stomach like Zack, her head to the left, her eyes open and her mouth frozen in a tiny O. She was stabbed more than a dozen times, in the breasts and torso, and then in the face, neck, back, arms, and legs. Now back to the scene. The comforter on the bed has been pulled back on the left side, showing a large blood pool where Zack was first stabbed while lying in bed. There is blood spatter on the wall behind the bed, and a thick sea of blood embedded in the floor where he died. There is blood spatter on the armoire and all over the nearby floor where Melanie lay as she died. Two more facts. Judging from the fresh semen found inside Melanie and on Zack's genitalia, it seems clear that the two of them had had sexual intercourse not long before they were killed. And as of now, barring DNA testing that is still pending, there is no physical evidence putting Noah Walker in this house. No fingerprints, no carpet fibers, no shoe or boot prints. And now the theory the STPD and the district attorney are running with. Noah was obsessed with Melanie. He somehow learned of her affair with Zack and followed her here. We don't know how he got in. The front door should have been locked, and no damage was done to it. In any event, he lay in wait until they had completed their sexual intercourse, when they were relaxed, when their guard was down, to spring into the room. Noah surprised Zack in bed, plunging his knife into Zack's chest and dragging the blade downward, causing a vertical cut of roughly 5 inches, tearing open the esophagus and stomach. At this point, Melanie, who was in the bathroom cleaning up, came out. Noah subdued her by the dresser, knocking over the books and alarm clock and stabbing her multiple times in the breasts and torso before throwing her to the floor by the armoire, where he continued to stab her from behind, slicing her cheek and ear and neck, and then her back, arms, and legs. He then returned to Zack and threw him out of the bed and onto the floor, stomping on and crushing some of Zack's fingers in a blind rage. I moved to the corner beyond where Zack's body was found and squat down, trying to get the angle right and using the photos to make sure I'm accurate. Where Zack would have been lying on the floor, with his head to the right, his sightline travels beyond the edge of the bed to the armoire. I repeat the same exercise from Melanie's vantage point and get the same line of vision from the opposite end. I remove my compact from my purse and squat down by the leg of the armoire that Melanie's right hand touched. I curl the compact under the armoire and around the leg so I can see the back of it. As I thought, the wood is abraded, scraped and cut. 10 minutes later, I'm walking on Ocean Drive toward Main Street on my cell phone with Uncle Lang. Melanie Phillips was handcuffed to the armoire's leg, I say. He made her watch the whole thing. This wasn't an act of blind rage, Chief. This was a calculated, well-executed act of sadism. Chapter 7. I get back to my car and drive to see the chief, who is away from the office this afternoon. Don't ever tell him he has the day off, because he'll spend a half hour explaining that the chief of police never has a day off. My uncle lives on North Sea Road in a 3-bedroom cottage set back from the road and flanked with well-manicured shrubbery that always reminds me of a defensive military formation. The front door is unlocked and open. It smells like it always smells in here. musty guy scent. Dirty socks and body odor combined with the latest fast food takeout he ate. A bachelor pad, ever since Aunt Chloe left him 2 years ago. On my way to the back porch, I detour to the kitchen, open his fridge, and peer inside. Cartons of Chinese takeout, half a Subway sandwich in its wrapping, a 12-pack of Budweiser with 3 cans remaining, a long stick of summer sausage, a pizza box shoved in the back. Oh yes, and then a tall plastic container of sliced fruit that's packed to the rim, and a batch of veggie lasagna still in the shrink-wrap casserole dish, with only one square cut out of the corner. I find Uncle Lang out back, sitting in a chair overlooking his lawn, a water sprinkler doing its thing. The air steamy as a sauna. Lang is wearing a button-down shirt and slacks and decent loafers. I'd forgotten he had that fundraiser earlier today.
"Hey, Missy,"
he says to me. His eyes are small and red. The glass of gin in his hand isn't his first of the day. He probably drank gin at the fundraiser and pretended it was ice water. I kiss his forehead and sit in the chair on the other side of the small glass table, the one holding the bottle of Beef Eater. "You haven't touched the fruit I cut up for you," I say. "And the veggie lasagna? What's the deal there? You preserving it for posterity?" He sips his gin.
"I don't like spinach. I told you that."
"Yeah?" I turn to him. "And what's your excuse for the fruit?" He waves me off.
"I don't know. It's mushy."
"It's pineapple and melon and cantaloupe. You like them."
"Well, it's mushy."
"That's because you let it sit there for a week. I cut it up a week ago and you didn't touch it. Not one piece." I whack the back of my hand against his shoulder.
"Ow. Don't hit me."
"I'll hit you if I want to hit you. You're like a child. You're like a little kid. That spinach lasagna is delicious."
"Then you eat it."
"Hopeless," I say. "You're hopeless. You know your doctor's appointment is next week. You think Dr. Childress is going to say, 'Congratulations, Chief, a month of eating meatball sandwiches and fried chicken and french fries did the trick. Your cholesterol has plummeted.'" Lang pushes the empty second glass over toward me and gives me a crosswise look.
"Don't think I don't know what you're doing, Missy."
"I'm looking out for the well-being of my only living family."
"No, you're deflecting. You call me up and tell me you've been to the crime scene, which you know you're not supposed to do since this isn't your case, so you try to put me on the defensive about my eating habits."
I pour myself a glass of gin. One won't kill me. 10 gets you 20 that the abrasions on the armoire leg came from a handcuff. He made each of them watch the other die, I say. He immobilized Zach and he handcuffed Melanie to the armoire. He made them watch each other bleed out.
"Jenna."
"This guy knew what he was doing," I say. "He stabbed Zach in a place where he wouldn't die instantly. I mean, he could have sunk that knife into his heart or slit his throat. Instead, he stabbed him in a place that would cause incredible pain and a slow death. And when Zach made any feeble attempt to raise himself up, he stomped on his hands. And he did the same thing to Melanie. Every time she tried to move, he stabbed her. She kicked her legs, and he stabbed her in the calf. She raised her free arm, and he stabbed her in the triceps."
"Jenna."
"These were sadistic, brutal torture murders," I say. "Not crimes of passion committed by a jealous lover."
"Crimes of passion can be sadistic, Jen."
"Do you really think if Noah was in love with Melanie, he'd watch Zach have sex with her first? Why wouldn't he rush in while they were in the heat of it?"
"Hey,"
the chief shouts.
"Do I get a word in here? I've heard enough. There is protocol and there is a chain of command, and nobody breaches that in Southampton. If you think just because you're my niece..."
"Of course I don't think that. And I'm just trying to help."
"You're not helping. You're not helping at all."
The chief coughs into his fist, his face turning red. He needs to take better care of himself. I can make all the heart-healthy meals the culinary world has to offer, but I can't make him eat them. I can tell him to walk a couple of miles a few times a week, but I can't walk them for him. He ignores every bit of advice I give him. He openly defies me on a daily basis. So why do I love this grouchy old man so much? Why am I not helping? I ask. Lang polishes off his glass of gin and composes himself.
"Because Noah Walker confessed,"
he says. I draw back.
He confessed? Ah, the hotshot from NYPD doesn't have all the answers, does she? Lang pours himself another inch of gin. He confessed this morning, so don't you go writing up a report that I'll have to show a defense lawyer. Not when this thing is tied up in a bow.
Noah confessed, I mumble, raising the glass to my lips. I'll be damned.
Noah Walker is guilty, and Noah Walker confessed, he says. So do me a favor and move along.
Chapter 8. The dive bar is aptly named, dark in every way, from the dim lighting to the oak furnishings, with the Yankees on the big screen, mirrors behind the bar sponsored by various breweries, and nothing but some fried appetizers on the menu for those who dare eat. But the people are friendly and laid back. It's a place to disappear, and disappearing sounds good to me at the moment. It started as a glass of wine, and then it became three, and I'm thinking it's five now. Once I started, I couldn't think of a good reason to stop. This place is locals only. Tradesmen and laborers and the occasional cop, which I prefer, because it's high season in the Hamptons and all the money's in town. Not that I don't enjoy seeing men with cardigans tied around their necks and women with so much work done on their faces that they've begun to resemble the Joker. Just not on my day off. And not after the day I've had, making a jerk out of myself in front of my uncle, the guy who gave me a second chance. I should stop drinking. My thoughts are swimming and my mood is darkening. I'm still not sure I made the right move, coming to the Hamptons. I could have found something else to do in Manhattan, or I could have tried to find another big city and start over, even if I had to start at the bottom rung again on patrol. But my uncle, the chief, made me an offer, and nobody else was knocking down my door. Shit, I say, the words slow and heavy on my tongue. I check my watch and it's nearing 6 o'clock in the evening. I haven't eaten anything since breakfast and my stomach is hollowed out and churning. Some might argue that's an apt summary of my life, too.
Whatever, man. Whatever. You know I'm good for it. How long I been coming here?
The small outburst comes from the guy at the end of the bar, whom I've managed not to notice since I've been here. Or maybe he just arrived. My brain isn't hitting on all cylinders right now. He's dressed the same way he was today at Melanie Phillips's funeral. A dark t-shirt that I might otherwise use to wipe my kitchen counter. A green ball cap turned backward. His long straw-like hair popping out on both sides and covering his ears. Jerry, I say to the bartender. That's a good bartender name, Jerry. Put his beer on my tab. Jerry, a portly guy with a big round head and a green apron, gives me a crosswise look. I nod and he shrugs, pulling on the lever to fill Aiden Willis's mug with a Budweiser he couldn't afford. Aiden's deep-set eyes move in my direction. He doesn't say anything. There may be a glint of recognition, if he noticed me at the cemetery. My biggest flaw as a cop is my bright red hair. When I was undercover for a year and a half and didn't want to be memorable, I dyed it black. I go back to my Pinot, trying to remind myself that I'm off duty, but wondering if Aiden, the cemetery caretaker, will come over. When I glance back up a few minutes later, Aiden is still looking at me, his beer untouched. He doesn't acknowledge me in any way, just stares with those raccoon eyes. But even his stare isn't really a stare. His eyes move about, wandering aimlessly, always returning to me, but never staying on me. My cell phone buzzes, a text message.
10 minutes away. Are you at home?
The message reads. My hesitation to respond surprises me, but there it is.
Always trust your gut,
my father used to say.
Sometimes it's all you have.
Well, Pop, I had a gut feeling about Noah Walker, and look where that got me. I type in the address of the bar and hit send. I look back to the corner of the bar where Aiden's mug remains full of beer, but Aiden himself is gone. I'm into my next glass, which now puts me at about five too many, if anyone's counting, when the door of the place pops open and a lot of people's chins rise. I don't even need to turn around to know it's Maddie, who would stick out in this place like an oil stain on cotton. A moment later, an arm comes over my shoulder and playfully around my neck. his cologne greets me next, before his face is against mine. This is where I'm supposed to swoon with unbridled delight. Hey, gorgeous. What's with the depressing bar thing? Maddie Queenan is a Wall Street investor with a job I can't really describe because I've never really understood all the financial hocus-pocus these guys pull. All I really understand is that it's a game without rules. You pick a winner for your clients, then bet on them to lose behind their backs, and if everything goes to shit, the little guy will get screwed, but the government will bail you out. Want a drink? I ask Maddie. Here? No. Let's go someplace decent. I look at Jerry, who pretends he didn't hear what Maddie just said. Seriously, Murphy, this place is a dump. I'm gonna need a tetanus shot. Keep your voice down. I'm standing now, whispering harshly in his ear. People can hear you. You're being rude. He takes me by the arm, but I pull away. Jerry, I say, I apologize for my rude friend, and please buy everyone around on me. I slap a 50 on the bar, having already paid for my other drinks, and get some applause for the gesture, along with some hard stares in my boyfriend's direction. I hear my cell phone ring in my purse, but I'm too hacked off to do anything but storm out of the place. Maddie, not far behind. Chapter 9. What's with the asshole routine? I say to Maddie as soon as I'm back in the sweltering heat outside.
What's with being half in the bag before I show up? What's with hanging out in a seedy dive like that?
I turn to look at my boyfriend of 11 months, the first two of which we spent together when I lived in the city, the last 9 of which have been long distance. I probably am a little tipsier than I should be, but he didn't even call and let me know he was coming until a few hours ago when he was already on his way. That's Maddie for you. Always on his own schedule, just assuming I'll drop everything and jump into his arms when he shows up. Okay, to be fair, it's not like I was working on my doctoral thesis or trying to end world hunger when he called. I turn back to him. Maddie looks like a Wall Street guy even when he dresses down, in an Armani sport coat, silk shirt, and expensive trousers with Ferragamo shoes that would consume an entire paycheck of mine, his long hair slicked back. He's got the looks, no doubt. His confidence, more than anything, drew me to him when we met. Guess where? At a bar in Midtown.
Don't get me wrong,
he says, moving to me.
I like when you're tipsy.
I push his hands away. Those people in there are nice folks. You insulted them. He thinks for a moment, then puts a hand on his chest.
Then I will march back in there and give a bar-wide apology.
Will that make Jenna happy? He doesn't wait for an answer, instead raising his arm and checking his watch.
I just decided something, he says. I guess I'm supposed to ask what. A few one-liners leap to mind. I just decided that this place is bad for you. You don't belong here. Just seeing you in the bar seals it. You need the city, kiddo. This place is depressing you.
Manhattan would depress me, I say. Even though in some ways there's no place I'd rather be. There's no place like it in the world. But I got to know it through a cop's eyes, and seeing it otherwise now would be like a cruel joke every day.
Well, we need to figure something out,
he says as we reach his Beamer, fire engine red with a beige interior.
This commute is a bitch.
It'll be better after Labor Day when the Rockefellers and Vanderbilts take off.
Talk about depressing.
He says as he uses his remote to pop the locks.
Summer's the only time this place is interesting.
Hey, he says as I open the passenger door. Hey, what? He nods at me.
Are you gonna change? We're going to Quist.
For the first time, I take an inventory of myself. I'm wearing a sleeveless white blouse, blue jeans, and low heels. But even the nicest places, and Quist is the nicest, a hotel restaurant opened by some celebrity chef, have a pretty relaxed dress code in the summer.
Let's swing by your place,
he says.
Wear that lavender dress I bought you. Then you'll be turning heads.
But I won't turn heads in this. He chuckles at his faux pas.
Come on, you know what I mean. We're going to a 5-star restaurant. You really want to look like that?
I hike my purse back over my shoulder and remember my cell phone, the call I missed a moment ago. I pull out my iPhone and see that the call came from Uncle Langdon, which I really should change to Chief James now. Taking another look at my phone, I see that the chief actually called me twice. Once a minute ago and once 24 minutes ago. Still standing outside the car, I dial him back.
Jenna Rose,
he answers, the only person who's ever incorporated my middle name when addressing me. The only one who's lived to tell about it anyway.
I was about to give up on you.
How can I help you, Chief? Were you looking for my recipe for grilled asparagus? It's not that hard. Just grill the asparagus.
No, Missy, not just now. You wanted to work a homicide, right?
I spring to attention. Yes, sir, absolutely.
Then get your butt in gear, detective,
he says.
You just got a homicide. One you may never forget.
Chapter 10. It's my job. It's not like I have a choice, I say to Maddie, his knuckles white on the leather steering wheel of his Beamer as we drive along the back roads. A woman was murdered.
It can't wait until after dinner. She'll still be dead.
I close my eyes. You didn't really just say that, did you? The back roads are narrow and winding and unforgiving, two lanes at best, with no shoulders. Driving them in the dark is even worse. But without the back roads, the locals in Bridgehampton would collectively commit suicide during the tourist season, when the principal artery, Main Street, or if you prefer, Montauk Highway, is clogged like a golf ball in a lower intestine. I passed up Yankees tickets on the third baseline, he says. Sabathia against Beckett in game one. I know. I watched it in the bar. Sabathia got tagged for 6 earned runs in 5 innings. It's my job, I say again. What am I
No, it's not.
What do you mean it's not?
Not tonight, it's not.
We find our destination, lit up by the STPD like a nighttime construction job, spotlights shining on the scene deep within the woods. The road has been reduced to one lane by traffic cones and flares. Maddie pulls up, puts it in park, and shifts in his seat to face me.
Don't act like you have no choice. There are detectives on duty right now. You're not one of them. You didn't have to take this assignment. You wanted it.
I pinch the bridge of my nose. Sorry about your Yankees tickets.
Jenna, come on.
I step out of the Beamer and flash my badge to the uniform minding the perimeter. I dip under the crime scene tape and watch my step as I walk through the woods, with their uneven footing and stray branches. It's a large lot, undeveloped land full of tall trees with a for sale sign near the road. Whoever did this picked a remote location. Isaac Marks approaches me.
Brutal. He says. Come on.
I follow him through the brush, my feet crunching leaves and twigs.
The guy who owns this lot found her,
he says.
Nice old guy, late 70s. He was stopping by for some routine maintenance and heard a swarm of insects buzzing around.
I slow my approach when I see her. It's hard to miss her under the garish lighting. She looks artificial, like a museum exhibit. Woman in repose. Except in this case, it would be more like woman with a tree stump through her midsection.
Jesus, I mumble.
The woman is naked, arms and legs splayed out, her head fallen back as she lies suspended several feet off the ground, impaled on the trunk of a tree that has been shaved down to the point of a thick spear. Technicians are working her over right now, photographing and gently probing her. The insects buzzing around her are fierce. She suffered some animal bites, too. That, plus the look of her skin, gives me an approximate window on time of death. She died maybe 1-2 days ago, I say. Isaac looks at me.
Very good, detective. At least that's what the ME is saying at first glance. 1-2 days.
That's a significant difference, 1 versus 2 days.
Yeah? Why?
2 days ago, I say. Noah Walker was a free man. But one day ago, we took him into custody, and he couldn't have done this.
You're connecting this with Noah Walker?
Isaac gives me a crosswise glance.
This is nothing like those murders.
I move in for a closer look at the victim. This nameless woman, hardened and discolored now, with the ravages of nature having taken their toll, is hard to categorize. I'm thinking she's pretty young, from the bone structure and lithe build. Early 20s, maybe. Would appear to be nice features and beautiful brown hair hanging down inches from the grass. She was pretty. Before some monster impaled her on a wooden spear like a sacrificial offering to the gods, this woman was pretty.
No ID yet, says Isaac. But we have a missing persons from Sag Harbor that we think will check out. If it does, then this is, he flips open a notepad and holds it in the artificial light, Bonnie Stamos, age 24. Couple of arrests for, take a wild guess.
She was a working girl. Not terribly surprising. The clients a prostitute serves come in all shapes and sizes, but it's like I felt when I was on patrol, approaching a car I'd just pulled over. You're never really sure what's waiting for you.
This is totally different than what we found on Ocean Drive, Isaac says. Those were a bloodbath. This thing is, what, posed, I guess? Dramatic, like some ritual thing, some ancient Mayan ceremony. How do you connect these two crimes?
I squat down next to the tree stump and gesture at it. See the side of the tree and the surrounding grass and dirt?
I see blood everywhere, if that's what you mean.
Exactly, I say. Blood everywhere. Her heart was still pumping. That's how I connect these crimes.
Not following.
She was still alive when he did this, when he impaled her on the tree trunk. I stand back up and feel a wave of nausea. The symbolism was incidental, a means to an end, I say. He wanted her to die a slow death, Isaac. He wanted her to suffer. Chapter 11. The chief has the porch light on for me when I walk up the steps to his house. The squad car that drove me here idles in the driveway. The door is open, and Uncle Lang has a bottle of gin and two glasses on the kitchen table. Dirty dishes are piled high in the sink, just as they were earlier today, with evidence of meal choices. Remnants of dried ketchup or smears of brown gravy, a bit of hamburger. The floor could use a good wash, too. The clock on the wall says it's almost 2 a.m. My uncle doesn't look well. He's gained a lot of weight since Aunt Chloe left him 2 years ago. His face is splotchy, broken capillaries on his prominent nose, his eyes rimmed with heavy bags. He's wearing a wife-beater t-shirt that accentuates his added poundage, tufts of curly white chest hair peeking over the top.
You don't look good, he says to me.
I kiss him on the forehead before I turn to the refrigerator. I was just thinking the same about you. Still drinking, I see. I take another glance into his refrigerator. The fruit container still hasn't been touched, but a second square is missing from the pan of spinach lasagna. I look back at him with an eyebrow raised.
See, he says. I listened to you.
Yeah? I take a seat across from him. And if I look through your trash, will I find an entire square piece of lasagna without a bite taken?
Now you've insulted me. I'm insulted.
That's not a denial. But I can't spend every waking moment hectoring him.
I'm serious, though, Uncle Lang says. You look worn out. Are you still having nightmares?
I shrug. It's been a thing since I returned to Bridgehampton. Usually they come at night. The sensation of choking, the terror, the desperate cries. What happened to me today at 7 Ocean Drive was the first time it ever happened during daylight. Lang pours me an inch of gin and slides the glass across the table.
Maybe you never should have come back here.
The thought has crossed my mind. It leads to another thought. Why did my family stop coming here when I was a kid? I ask. The chief shrugs.
A story for another time.
So there's a story. Something happened. Lang casts a fleeting glance at me, then deflects.
Did you move the body tonight?
I nod. We had to cut the tree from underneath her. Didn't want to separate her from the trunk yet. Never know what forensics might pick up.
Good. Good that you moved her. I don't need to see photos in the patch tomorrow. This is a dead hooker, detective. Not a dead hooker who was split in half on a tree stump like some human shish kebab. Understand me? A dead hooker to the media. That's it. Just another hooker, adios in the Hamptons. That's a one-day story. A one-day story. Appearances. Politics. There's an election coming up, and the town supervisor is already feeling heat from the Zach Stern, Melanie Phillips murders. Another sensational murder would just add pressure. It's good police procedure, too, not mentioning gory details to the press. In Manhattan, that plan never worked. The NYPD leaked like a colander. But here, it might.
Your case has nothing to do with Noah Walker,
Lang says. Oh, Isaac, you little shit. Talk about leaks. No wonder the chief wanted to meet me tonight. Isaac must have snuck away from me in a free moment and called him. So now I know where his loyalties lie, that little twerp. Too early to tell, I say. The chief casts his eyes in my direction. He takes a sip of Beef Eater and lets out a breath.
A few hours ago, you thought Noah was an innocent man, wrongly accused. Now you like him for the carnage in the woods, too.
I don't like him or dislike him. Not yet. But it's possible the prostitute was killed while Noah was still a free man, not yet in custody. I'm just playing all the angles. That's what I'm paid to do. He makes a noise as he finishes another sip.
No, you're paid to do what I tell you to do.
I'm a detective, I say. Once in a while, I try to detect. The gin is sharp on my tongue, hot down my throat, leaving a delicious citrus aftertaste. Tastes better than it should. I take the bottle and pour myself another. Let me ask you a question, Chief. He shows me a wary look but doesn't speak. Why did we go in so hard on the arrest?
What do you mean?
He pours himself another drink. When we arrested Walker, the SWAT team, the automatic weapons, we were braced for a firefight. Noah didn't have any weapons. The chief's jaw tightens, but he doesn't make eye contact with me.
Missy, you're lucky you're my favorite niece.
I'm your only niece.
Don't fuck with my case, Jenna.
He slams down his glass.
I've got Noah Walker dead to rights. I need that solved. I've got orders from on high. You start tying this dead hooker murder in with it, then we have to turn your report over to Walker's lawyer, and he'll play with that window of time. Maybe 2 days, maybe three, maybe Noah was already in custody when the hooker got hers. And suddenly, Clarence Darrow is saying that one person did both murders, and that one person couldn't have been Noah Walker.
And what if that's true? My uncle gives me a look that I remember seeing as a child. That look an adult gives when a kid is being adorably precocious. A combination of pride and annoyance. But in this case, the annoyance is outweighing the pride.
Stay away from Noah Walker. Don't make your case something it's not.
Just another hooker adios in the Hamptons, right? I push myself out of the chair. I'm not gonna do it. I'm following the leads wherever they go. You don't like it? Relieve me. The chief looks exhausted. He gestures toward me, the sign of the cross, absolution from a priest.
You are hereby relieved of any responsibility for the dead hooker in the woods.
That's bullshit, Lang. With the back of my hand, I whack my glass off the table, smashing it against the sink.
Yeah? You want to go for a suspension, too?
Sure.
Great. You're suspended without pay for a week.
Only a week? I yell, lost in my rage now, spinning out of control.
Fine, then a month. How about a dismissal? You want me to can ya?
The chief rises from his chair, directing a finger at me.
And before you answer that, Missy, remember that being a cop is all you know. And I gave you a second chance. You'd think that would buy me just a little bit of loyalty from you, but oh no.
I shake my head, fuming. I can't believe you just said that. He waves me away with a hand.
1 month suspension, detective. Effective immediately. Now get out of my house.
Chapter 12. For the first time in over a week, he breathes fresh air. He walks in grass. He wears his own clothes. He sees the sun, not over a concrete wall for 1 hour a day, but out in the open. Noah Walker takes a moment to savor it before he steps into the minibus that will transport him to the train station for passage from Riverhead to Bridgehampton. When he's home, he first takes a shower. No fancy shower head or immaculate tub, but at least a healthy flow of water, without mold on the fixtures, without raw sewage bubbling from the drain, without having to look over his shoulder to wonder whether he was going to have an unexpected visitor. The biggest problem with Suffolk County Jail in Riverhead was the temporary nature of it all. Nobody in Riverhead had been convicted of a crime. If they had, they'd be in prison. Riverhead was just a pre-trial holding facility for people with unaffordable bail or no bail at all, and thus, there was nothing in the way of remedial programs or education, no recreational facilities, no pretense of nutritious meals. It was just walls, a handful of books, a chaplain on Sunday, shit for food, and an overpopulation of pissed-off detainees. He met someone inside, a guy named Rufus, who'd been in county lockup for over 4 years waiting for his trial. None of that for Noah. He's demanded a speedy trial, his constitutional right. He can't stomach the thought of waiting months, even years, wondering. Out of the shower, hair dripping wet, feeling warm and refreshed, he picks up his cell phone and hits the speed dial.
"Are you out?"
Paige says breathlessly when she answers. "I'm out," he says, thanks to her, and the checking account that bears only her name, that her husband